Welcome back to Conduct Detrimental. I'm Daniel Wallach, along with my co-host, Dan Lust. You know, Dan, I have to say, in my vision for starting Conduct Detrimental with Dan Worley three years ago now, I never envisioned that we would have an episode dedicated to roller derby. You know, when I was a kid, roller derby was a staple of late night television on WOR Channel 9. And of course, there was the regional telecasts all over the country, the LA Thunderbirds, the New York Bombers. It was a huge, huge thing. And then it fell off the face of the earth. I guess the leagues disbanded in the 1970s. How on earth did we circle back to roller derby one half a century later?
Well, Dan, when I was a younger sports law lust, people would ask me what my favorite movie would be. And because I didn't know any better, I would say Rollerball, starring Keanu Reeves. So I think Rollerball is in our DNA, Dan. I really do feel that way. So, you know, but Dan, that's what happens when you get a tip from Dr. Tina Butera, a friend of mine on Twitter. She sent me a screenshot from the Cleveland Guardian's Facebook page. And she just said, have you seen this? And I looked at the screenshot and it looked like people in the Guardian's page were kind of up in arms that the baseball team, you know, had announced the name change. So guess what, Dan? I didn't know if this was a story or not. I just put it on Twitter. That's how I do it. And I said, did the Cleveland Guardians forget to check Google? And Dan, 48 hours later, you have people questioning the Cleveland baseball team's trademark lawyers if they have any concept of what they're doing. I'll take a little bit of credit for that. Hopefully the Cleveland baseball team is not mad at me, but I'm just reporting the facts here.
I hate to rain on your parade. By the way, they got a lot of traction on social media, and it was a great tweet, and you sort of ran with it for a day, but there was zero chance on earth that Major League Baseball and the Cleveland Indians' extensive legal staff and intellectual property experts and outside counsel didn't do a basic Google search. I have a little anecdote by comparison here, just to sort of personalize it. When I started Conduct Detrimental and I formed the website, you better believe Daniel Wallach alone, without any counsel or experts, by myself, I did a GoDaddy search. I did a SunBiz search on the Florida Division of Corporate Records. And I also did a Google search for the name Conduct Detrimental. And only then did I proceed with the trademark and the domain name and the corporate registration. So this has been out there for at least 2 months. This is not news to anybody, although I think people forgot about some of the prior reporting. But let's dig into some of the legal issues. So from your lens, where do you see this going?
So this is why we have a podcast. And Dan, I hear you. I'll respectfully disagree with something that you just said, but we have a podcast for this very reason, to talk about issues at the intersection of sports and law. So first and foremost, we're going to get into the Cleveland Guardians debacle. Second, a rather big update on the Deshaun Watson front. And third, I think, an issue we touched on last week with Texas and Oklahoma, that has now gone to its next logical level. They have announced their intention to leave the conference. So we'll get into that, what the bylaws kind of state and what could be in store for the other Power Five conferences and maybe some of the minor conferences around the college landscape. And last but not least, an issue that has since come up, NFL's, we'll say, their battle with COVID law and the vaccination debate. So we'll get into all of that. So now, Dan, going back to the Cleveland Guardians, I know I wasn't the first one to talk about the fact that a roller derby team existed. I saw maybe some articles maybe 2-3 days before. And I know as of May, that name Cleveland Guardians was being centered on. I know you tweeted out an article that I think in December, somebody trademarked the name or attempted to trademark the name from New York, the Cleveland Guardians name. Now, I'll say this. Do I think that the Cleveland Guardians, you know, the baseball team in their infinite wisdom, Googled the name? I'm sure they did. Did they realize that somebody had a website, clevelandguardians.com? I would hope so. And how about the Instagram handle, Cleveland Guardians, that somebody else possessed it? Did they realize that these were all the same entity, a Cleveland Guardians that existed not in just Ohio, right? Like in their own backyard. This was not like Hawaii Cleveland or New York Cleveland. They knew this team existed. Now, here's the question for you that I have, Dan, with these giant lawyers with their massive brains that are these white shoe lawyers getting paid thousands of dollars to Google this, right? Why announce the name Cleveland Guardians without securing the website, without securing the social media accounts, without ironing out those issues? That's what is the million-dollar question, because I think we can agree they did not do that.
Well, yeah, but that doesn't suggest that they were caught off guard and they were just, oh, my God, we didn't even know this existed. I mean, this was in plain sight, simple Google searches, moreover, you know, media reporting. But I think it does go back to the issue. Why would the Indians even announce the change before securing all those rights, the domain name, the social media accounts, you know, the having the assignment. Oh, they don't even need a trademark assignment, but the Indians have been objecting to other trademark registrations surrounding the Cleveland Guardians name. I mean, they've been filing objections to that New York person who attempted to file the Guardians. They filed objections to that in the USPTO website, you know, many, many months ago. So I think that this was something that has been in discussion, and they were probably ongoing discussions between the roller derby group and the Indians baseball team, whether or not they have a deal, who knows? But I think what's really relevant are the fact that the other side is not coming out with guns a-blazing saying, you know, this is ours and you've got to pay us. There are no comment, or at least refusal to be outwardly hostile is somewhat suggestive of the fact that they're already in discussions with the Indians and that a deal is imminent. I mean, after all, how much would it take to buy all right, title, and interest to both the name, the domain names, the social media accounts? Would half a million do it? Would a million do it? That's a drop in the bucket. I would expect that to be an inevitability. What I pointed out on Twitter is the bigger issue here. This might be a great opportunity to raise consciousness around roller derby. No one has thought of this sport in such a long time. And there are hundreds of leagues throughout the world, a pool of talent in roller derby. You could easily create a revived, you know, league. This was a major sport in the 1960s and 70s. I'm not saying it could ever rival what it once was, but I think with all the different, you know, media channels, streaming, cable networks, and with the advent of legal sports betting, maybe there's a niche market for roller derby, and this could be the beginning of the examination of that opportunity.
So, you know, Dan, I put out a poll. Who looked more incompetent with the handling of their team, in the Cleveland baseball team or the Washington football team? And, you know, maybe people's memories are short. You know, overwhelmingly the vote was for Cleveland baseball team. But you and I, we had an episode about a year ago. People can look at it, you know, in the archives. You know, friend of the show, Darren Heitner, signed up a client named Martin McCauley, who for a couple of months, if not years, I think he made it a hobby of finding names that the Washington football team was going to pick, be it the Washington Monuments. You know, he picked a lot of Washington-based names, and he basically held the Washington football team hostage. And maybe the reason that they still have not picked a name is because of this guy, Martin McCauley. So, you know, what did Washington do wrong? They, for about 4 or 5 years, should have known that the name was going to be taken away. The U.S. Patent Trademark Office took that name away, said it was too offensive to be trademarkable, to be protectable. And then the Redskins, you know, had no backup plan. So now they're still the Washington football team. Now, what did the Indians do? I don't know. I think their big flaw in this, Dan, is rushing it. And we can get into the legalese a little bit, but I'm not sure of the wisdom of why they had to announce this past week, hey, we're going with the Guardians. That's the name. And, you know, that it is what it is, when you and I can both agree, right? Like maybe they knew, right? You know, Josh Gerben, who's another, you know, sports law and trademark space, he goes, of course, they knew about this team name. That makes it worse, right? What was the rush? If you don't have the website yet, why are you rushing to announce that that's the name? So here's just, you know, maybe the negotiation standpoint. Let's say you're the general counsel of the Cleveland Indians, right? And you're deciding, you know, you really like the Guardians name and you're probably going to go with it. Okay. And let's say now you need to pick up the phone and call the roller derby team and say, hey, we want to buy your website. If you tell them, hey, Guardians, we're deciding between 4 or 5 names. We're not really sure yet, you know, but we're going to buy all the IP and make a decision later. You have a lot of leverage, right? You don't have to pay them anything, because as far as the roller derby team knows, you'll pick some other name like the Cleveland Spiders or whatever other name. Now, by announcing it first, prior to securing the domain, prior to securing the Instagram account and the Facebook account, right? Or even Guardians.com, which at least as last I checked was up for sale on GoDaddy for $50,000. It doesn't look like the Cleveland baseball team owns any of these properties. What is the incentive to announcing ahead of time and then negotiating later? To me, you've lost all leverage and now you have to write a blank check. So can they buy their way out of this mistake? Sure, but the egg is on their face. And I think that's the story here, that they just made this big misstep and now maybe they could buy their way out of it, but it's still a big misstep.
Well, one thing we don't know, Dan, is what they know and what the Guardians and the Indians have been talking about behind the scenes. All we have to go on is the sort of the announcement that there's a name change. We're absolutely in the dark about the status of any negotiations. And maybe there was a point in their discussions where they pretty much had the essence of a deal in place. And the Indians say, okay, we're going to go ahead and do this announcement. And maybe they still have to execute some of the transfer documents. Who knows? I'm not giving anybody the benefit of the doubt other than to say that there's a lot that we don't know about what's transpired. But let's face it, this is not a situation where the Guardians roller derby team is going to be able to extract anything really significant, like mid seven figures or eight figures. Let's talk about their use in commerce. Let's, you know, this is a legal podcast. I think some of the core issues that would be looked at is the extent to which the Guardians have been used in commerce by the roller derby franchise. They haven't played in over 2 years since the pandemic, or presumably because of the pandemic, they have not played. They don't sell t-shirts. They do have a Facebook and a domain, a website, but they don't appear to be selling any goods. They simply have a very low profile, you know, roller derby team that even within Cleveland was unbeknownst to 99.9% of the population in all likelihood, which dovetails with the most important element, whether there would be any actual consumer confusion or likelihood of confusion. And there are arguments, I think, on both sides of the equation. I mean, you're looking at the same name, the same city, a sport. I could conceive of some people who might be confused by that. But I think in reality, if you were to utilize any kind of like surveys and polling and any kind of circumstantial evidence, such as, you know, I guess the kind of public polling that would have to be taken to prove or disprove the absence or presence of consumer confusion, I think very few people would think of the roller derby origin when they see the Cleveland Guardians, you know, baseball logo and names on t-shirts. If anything, the media attention and the attendant publicity around this story, I think, has further created a divide and I guess a separation between the roller derby use and the baseball use. And I'm not very optimistic that if this did go into litigation, that the Guardian roller derby group would be able to prevail. And if they prevailed, would be able to recover substantial damages. But even with all that, I think it would be bad business and absence of goodwill to have this cloud over the Guardians name. And that's why either there's going to be an agreement coming out very soon, or the Indians should be incentivized to treat these people fairly, give them a significant, you know, buyout for their domain names and right to use the name, and maybe even sponsor their roller derby team. I think this could be an opportunity to make something out of nothing and create increased awareness around roller derby. This could be a win-win for both sides. I don't see this ever going to a trademark dispute in the, you know, U.S. Patent and Trademark Office or in a federal court.
So, friend of the show, the sneaker lawyer, if you know him on Instagram, he's going to write an article for us on conduct detrimental. He went into the kind of dueling trademark filings. He thinks that there might be something brewing, that certain marks were abandoned, but other ones were not. So he's just reading the tea leaves on the trademark pub. So I don't want to spoil that. You can check that out on the website. But what I'll say is this, Dan, maybe there's some tongue-in-cheekness. Maybe that's a word going on. But the Guardians, you know, again, I'm just looking at the evidence. Their website seemingly was kind of dormant for, looks like almost like 2 years, like pre-COVID, the end of
3 years. Did you catch that, Dan? That was pretty funny. We like checked out their website,
right?
And lo and behold, there's a new entry after 3 years.
But that tells you, like, that's a signal. Hey, we're not done. We're going to, you know, we're going to try to keep this in some way, shape or form. And the Facebook group, same thing. All of a sudden it's active. All of a sudden post, you know, Cleveland baseball team name change. So I don't know. Something tells me, Dan, this is not the end of the story. And I'll disagree with you. I put a poll up and I meant it. I do think there's probably going to be some big payday here. I'd imagine in the seven figures, because put it this way, and when we have some precedents, I'm not pulling that number out of nowhere. The Dallas Cowboys for a long period of time controlled cowboys.com. And if anybody watches The League, that old show about fantasy football, great show if you haven't watched it, they have a joke about how Taco, one of the characters, buys cowboys.com. So no, it's based on a real story. The Cowboys let that expire, and then someone bought it out from under them and then turned it into, you can check up the stories in this, it's very funny, I think a cowboy dating site. You know, it was just an odd way to use cowboys.com. But if you control that website and Cowboys fans are inclined to go to it, all of a sudden your brand and your image could be harmed. So I don't know. Cleveland Guardians having a roller derby page is not that big of a deal. It's not going to hurt the Cleveland baseball team's image. But I don't know. Let's say they sell that to somebody else and does something more illicit. That's why you want to control your IP. That's why even Dan, the smartest IP lawyers, were saying, hey, there was a mistake that was done in this. That was announcing the name prior to securing, you know, the domain, right? And that just the fact that they're entering the Cleveland Guardians, hey, we're looking forward to the 2022 roller derby season, tells you that the baseball team does not control what's going on in that account. So I don't know, Dan. I do think this is a pretty big misstep.
I ascribe a different reason to the revival of the once dormant, you know, website. They could very well be leveraging the fact that there's increased attention around roller derby and want to recruit players and want to, you know, entice people to follow their team. And why not take advantage of that opportunity and update your website, update your Facebook page? I mean, let's face it, just having a random entry isn't going to serve any great litigation advantage, you know, 3 years after the fact. Either there's a consumer confusion or actual confusion, or there's not. A random post on July 24th publicizing tryouts for roller derby players isn't going to be the, you know, the momentum changer in a trademark legal dispute. And what is it worth? I mean, I don't know who the people behind the roller derby team, but this is a very low profile situation. They haven't played in more than 2 years. They're going to get a great payday here. And I think the Indians want to give them a significant amount of money for the right to use their name and not litigate this in the trademark and trial appeals board or before a U.S. federal court. What's the dollar amount? Some people have speculated six figures. I read an article in Yahoo with some trademark experts quantifying or projecting that it might be mid six figures. I suspect it's going to be a little higher, but certainly less than the median Major League Baseball salary. I think you're looking at mid seven figures at best. And that's a drop in the bucket for a team that has a payroll of many multiples in that. At some point along the way, there's going to be a put up or shut up moment for the roller derby group. And if it becomes too much and it becomes sort of an extortionary situation or an extortionate amount that group is seeking to extract from the Indians will move on, because I view the last couple of days as almost a rollout or a trial of the name. And let's face it, most people have given the thumbs down to the Guardians name. It was horrible. Might give them a chance to reboot it.
Are you predicting that they could actually go back on the Guardians and go to the chosen name, I think, by Cleveland fans as the Cleveland Spiders? Are you saying there's a chance?
No, because admitting defeat or reversing their decision will likely be an egg on their face and would prove to be an embarrassment. So they're like all in on this. They're like going to be dead enders on securing the trademark rights. This is just writing a check, whether it's $5 million, $10 million. Who cares? It's going to get resolved, because this is going to be a windfall for a group that doesn't have the kind of financial wherewithal. And this is going to be a make or break for them. They're going to be able to really elevate the profile of their roller derby team. This is a major opportunity for the roller derby group to increase public attention and maybe increase, you know, fan interest.
So I'll say this, and then we should move to Watson. But I mean, the Dolan family is notoriously cheap. Cleveland's the same team that sent Francisco Lindor packing to the Mets. They didn't want to pay him his big salary. I'm sure Dolan would love to write a check for $5 million to a team because he's lost all leverage. No, I mean,
the truth runs in the family, Dan. The Dolan family, it's not just cheapness. The Dolan family has sort of genetic mismanagement of sports built into their DNA.
But in all seriousness, people are saying, oh, Dolan's a multi-multi-millionaire. He'll just buy him out. You don't become a multi-multi-millionaire by writing blank checks to roller derby teams. And I'm sure someone's getting in trouble for the mishandling of this, Dan. And if what you're saying, what you're predicting comes through and they say, oh, you know what? We got outsmarted by a roller derby team. Let's go back to the drawing board and pick a different name. Do you know how bad that would look? So I don't know. Anybody can tell me that this isn't a big deal, that Dolans will buy it out. Like, okay.
It's not that they'll buy them out. It's just that they've already been talking. They're so far down the continuum that you're assuming that this came out of left field. It did not come out of left field. This has already been in the public domain for several months.
I don't want to assume anything, Dan, because they say, you know how they say, right? You don't want to assume anything, right? As the saying goes in law school.
Felix Unger notably was quoted on The Odd Couple of, when you assume, you make an ass out of you and me.
Yes. I guess to put a pin in it, I don't want to assume what negotiations have occurred behind the scenes. I just know that as of today, right, or as of whenever we broke the story initially, they did not control those domains. They did not control the Instagram account.
Yeah. One tell here would be to kind of update and scan the Cleveland Indians website page to see if and when there's ever a change in the identity of the general counsel. If there's a new name as the general counsel, I guess that will tell you that somebody really screwed up.
Probably. And also, Dan, you know, if you go to right now, right, this is a fun exercise for people listening to the podcast, and then we'll move to Watson, right? Go to guardians.com. I want you to see what's there, because if you go to Yankees.com, you see a Major League Baseball team, right? That's what it's supposed to look like. You go to RedSox.com. You know, it's not Boston Red Sox, not New York Yankees. You go to Yankees, right? So I'm not just talking about Cleveland Guardians. That one belongs to the roller derby team. You go to Guardians.com, and at least as of right now, as of Tuesday at 11:46 Eastern time, that is available
for sale, right? There's someone putting that up for sale. And I went through the mechanism. A friend of mine helped me out with it. The person on the other end of this is asking for $50,000 for Guardians.com. So they didn't even secure Guardians.com. So people can say, oh, they have millions of dollars to spend. Well, why haven't they spent the $50,000 to buy Guardians.com? So we'll put a pin in this, Dan. You know, you and I could go back and forth. And I love when you and I have some disagreement on topics. It always makes for a more fun discussion. Okay, that said, let us turn over to the gridiron. We got three stories pertaining to football. Let us start with Deshaun Watson. So after kind of months of speculation, were they going to settle the case, not settle the case? We had one minor update and one fairly big update. The minor update's kind of fun. Let's hit it quick, and then we'll go to the major one. Minor one. Tony Busby has been on his honeymoon in some far off place. I think he's in Greece. I'm not exactly sure where this place is, but lovely pictures on the Tony Busby Instagram account. Shout out to Mr. Busby. But he posts from his lovely honeymoon a little bit of a loaded post. He basically called Deshaun Watson a horny teenager. And he goes, hey, it's possible. It's possible to have a massage because I had one today and I didn't grind on the table. I didn't do anything inappropriate. I didn't make the masseuse feel uncomfortable. I just had a normal, lovely massage. And here's a picture of me, a selfie with the masseuse. Weird move by Tony Busby, but tells you if you are very close to settling and all that's left is to wire a certain amount of money and sign the settlement papers, that's not the type of Instagram post you make as one of the lawyers. That's a pretty loaded one to kind of anger the other side. So anyone that's been paying attention to social, you know, I've been pretty clear. I don't think a settlement is what was happening. That was an Instagram post that occurred last week. So fast forward, we had a big update this week. Deshaun Watson agreed to report to camp rather than being fined $50,000 for holding out. So now that he's kind of at camp, people have said, okay, now Goodell's going to have to make a decision on whether or not he's going to be placed on the commissioner's exempt list. Because he's in uniform, he's going to make the shield look bad. If, you know, reporters are asking about his criminal case, they're going to have to put him on paid leave just like they did to Bauer, right? So yeah, he reports to camp, and we don't hear anything from Goodell. So guess what happens, Dan? Here's the update, and then I'll turn it to you. 10 women, 8 of which were named in the civil lawsuit, two of which that were not. So potentially 2 new women to the case. File criminal complaints directly with the police department. And I think that's a sign. It's the way I read it. Hey, if Watson's allowed to show up to camp and he's not going to get punished, guess what? We're going to speed up and we're going to expedite the criminal procedure here. We're going to go directly to police. We're going to issue new criminal complaints. And we're going to try to speed up the criminal charges here. So, Dan, I turn it to you. What are your thoughts on these recent developments?
Okay, well, Tony Busby is traveling the world on vacation in Greece. One thing he isn't doing is taking depositions in the case. This case was filed, these 22 lawsuits were filed, where were they, March and April? Deshaun Watson isn't slated to be deposed in this case until 2022, February. Where was Tony Busby? You know, I know they've exchanged some written documents, but they haven't gotten, Deshaun Watson under oath, nor has, Watson's attorney taken depositions of any of the complainants. So you have 22 lawsuits, and I've looked at the court docket in the Harris County District Court, and not everything gets posted on the docket, but I'm looking at 22 different lawsuits. The latest record activity in any of the cases, the most recent record activity is April of 2021, 3 months ago.
The deposition schedule, the scheduling order?
No, it's not a scheduling order. I think there was some early stage motion, there was answer to the complaint. Not a lot of record activity, and I understand discovery requests and the like are not necessarily filed in every state court case. You certainly cannot file them in federal court, but the absence of any deposition activity suggests that Busby is not actively litigating this case, and he's basically buying an index number and hoping to pressure Deshaun Watson into a settlement, knowing full well that the NFL is poised to drop the hammer on Watson in the form of paid leave, which would essentially allow Watson to receive a salary, but no NFL team would trade for him, which would really undermine Watson's desire to go to another NFL team. So in some ways, Busby holds all the cards because he thinks that as long as these cases remain outstanding, he's got Watson in a difficult spot, unable to basically be traded to another team, unlikely to play at any point, while these cases are pending, but he's done nothing to move the ball forward. And I think the filing or these 10 new criminal complaints, I think that's just, public relations and truly 8 of these 10 complainants were already civil plaintiffs and were included among the 22 lawsuits he filed. They're going to the police in July. What happened in March or April, and I'm not trying to diminish the severity of some of these allegations, but Busby's actions and inactions belie any serious attempt to progress this case to a judgment and seem designed more to extract the highest possible settlement from Deshaun Watson while doing the least amount of work.
Yeah, I can't really disagree with you. I guess two points to that. Case was filed, I think, right around March. So we've had a lot of time to kind of digest this. The depositions in this case, per the last scheduling order, is why I asked you what that last filing was. They're not supposed to be held until after the Super Bowl. So people that know the football calendar, that's going to be February of 2022. So I'm sure that, I don't know this for a fact, but if I'm Watson's attorney, I was probably asking for as late of a date as possible that the court standards and goals are going to allow. You know, and standards and goals is a fancy way that lawyers say judges, maybe this will go behind the scenes a little bit. Judges are graded on a number of things by the, Office of Court Administration. One of them is how quickly they can adjudicate a case. So, yeah, sure, you could delay depositions indefinitely, but, you know, the judge is going to get in trouble. So they want to kind of put, at least in where I'm from in New York, they want to put a kind of a schedule, a kind of tight schedule to kind of abide by. So who asked for the later date? Whose incentive does it bring to ask for a later date? Well, obviously Watson, right? Because he doesn't want to be deposed in the middle of an NFL season. That'll be an absolute media circus. Now,
he's going to be on administrative leave. There's not going to be any NFL season for him. His NFL season is no different than my NFL season. I'm going to be watching the games on television. If the NFL uses the Antonio Brown civil lawsuit standard as the sort of the basis for putting a player on paid leave.
Well, I guess, you know, we'll touch that. But I mean, you know, Antonio Brown wasn't with an NFL team. It was a little bit different. So they could basically suspend Antonio Brown. I'm going to say suspend in quotes, not make a decision on whether he was going to be disciplined or not because he didn't have a team. So it wasn't that he was in uniform. He was in no uniform. Sean Watson is one of the top players in the NFL, no matter which way you want to slice it. He's with the team. He's being paid a lot of money. So I guess before we go there, right, you delayed depositions out for a year. Tony Busby had to assent to that in some way, shape, or form. And once, Dan, you and I are on the same page, right? If they have depositions in this case, it's off the rails, right? You can't really unwind some type of deposition testimony like that. It's going to be really hard, you know, to get Watson's, his public perception back. He testifies under oath about what he did or didn't do. So I think Busby is trying to angle the case to settle prior to depositions. And that would be a reason why he would agree to a later deposition date. So if we're really trying to go in the weeds here. Okay, so that's step number one. Step number two, I was on ESPN Houston last night talking to a friend of the show, Pat Creighton. And he goes, Dan, don't you think the DA's office and police department thinks it's a little suspicious that they all are represented by the same lawyer? And that's the same narrative that keeps popping up. Why hasn't the police department and the DA's office accepted this case, right? Aren't the cards on the table? Don't we know what these women are alleging? How haven't they either said we're taking it or we're not taking it? So what I guess the word is in Houston, people are still curious as to why all of these women picked the same attorney. So I'm going to give you, I like to kind of try to call it like I see it, play it down the middle. Dan, let's say you and I, we have the Wallach and Luss law firm, which might occur at some point in time. Who knows? Who knows what fate will bring? And we set up shop in lovely Houston, Texas, for no apparent reason, right? It has better internet service than Novosibirsk, Russia. We want to set up shop in Houston, Texas, okay? And somebody comes to us, it's going to be our first client, and they happen to be a Deshaun Watson accuser. And they say, hey, will you represent us? So Dan, you and I talk about it, really excited. We're going to have a sports law case all pumped up. And then, Dan, we think about it. If our first case is suing the star quarterback of the hometown team, guess what? Not that many people are probably going to want to do business with us because we've attacked the hometown team. So I know a little bit of this narrative, a little bit from behind the scenes. I can't really divulge how I know this, but I know that people in Houston are not very happy with Tony Busby's law firm. So it's very possible that at least a handful of these women tried to go to other firms and which they said, no, this case is a little nuclear, but why don't you go try Tony Busby's office? He already has a couple of these, so I guess he's okay with it. So that, Dan, I don't know. I think it's a logical reason why Busby would have all these cases, honestly.
Yeah, honestly, I don't think there's any great public relations nightmare in representing clients suing a quarterback who has made a trade request and has made clear in pretty certain terms that he wants out of Houston. I just don't see the animus. I think to the extent that there's any animus directed at Tony Busby, I think the style in which he's litigated this case, because it comes across to many people as a shakedown and not a serious case. Look, if you and I were representing an accuser, we would put the pressure on Deshaun Watson right away. I wouldn't wait a year and a month before I took the first deposition. I'd hit the ground running, try to get him under oath as soon as possible, because constant pressure will increase the likelihood for settlement. Here, Busby seemingly is allowing the NFL to do his dirty work, because the only pressure that is going to be placed on Watson to push him into a settlement would be the actions that the NFL takes against him, which could either be conducting their its own parallel investigation and suspending him or placing him on administrative leave. And understandably, Watson is in a very difficult position because if he goes under oath, he subjects himself to possible criminal repercussions, the possibility of being charged. He also places himself in at risk with the National Football League. So he has two giant reasons to not testify as quickly as possible. So if you're a plaintiff's attorney, you want to press forward with depositions as quickly as possible, because if your goal is settlement, getting him under oath is sort of the moment of truth for Deshaun Watson. And most cases settle in situations like the many cases settle in situations like this in order to avoid the embarrassment of Deshaun Watson having to go under oath and talk about what were very likely sexual experiences that would either prove to be embarrassing at best or at worst indicative of criminal behavior.
Yeah, so I'm in a 1,000,000% agreement with you. When I tell clients when I have a case, I say most cases, right, 99.9% of cases settle before you get to trial. They'll either settle on the courthouse steps or they'll settle at some point in between. But when you have those big decision points, right before depositions, right before summary judgment motions, right before the trial, that's when things settle. So the first decision point in this case, you know, people are going to ask Dan and I, like, hey, what's going on in those cases? We're going to say not much. Discovery, paper discovery, text message, photos, they're going to be exchanged privately. And then depositions are the big day. But that tells you, you have, well, you know, 6 months, right? We have a long time until we get to depositions. So that seems to be, Dan, to your initial point, which I think is 100% spot on. Busby has set this case up in a way, hey, let's buy 8-10 months to try to settle this case before anything really has to happen. All the lawyers know nothing really happens before depositions. Now, Dan, let me give it to you. There's another kind of element to this that I do want to bring into the fold. I don't know if it's necessarily so legal, but you kind of have to play into this. So, okay, Dan, you and I are on the same page that we think that Watson is going to be placed in the commissioner's exempt list, that is paid leave.
Maybe not.
Well, then I'll say it. I think he's going to be placed in it at a certain point in time. I do think that. And why do I think that? You can just look over the pond at Major League Baseball that Rob Manfred has set up a precedent for Trevor Bauer. Hey, yeah. You get charged with sexual assault allegations. We don't want you on the field. Listen, it's nothing against you, Trevor. We don't think you're guilty. We're not saying anything really happened, but we have this mechanism called admin leave. We'll pay you your money, but we're going to take you off the field. So sexual assault comes in all shapes and sizes. I'm not saying one is better or one is worse. I'm just telling you a high profile player like Trevor Bauer has been hit with that remedy. So now you go over to football. Commissioner's exempt list is made for the same purpose. So I think he's going to be placed on it. I think as we get closer to the season, I think it'll certainly happen. Now, Dan, I'll give you this, right? Okay. Admin or paid leave means that whatever team has him, Watson won't be allowed to be on the field, but the team that controls him, right, that has him on the roster, will have to pay his salary, his mega $1 million salary. Okay, so this comes from Watson's quarterback coach. Adam Schefter tweeted this out. He went on record, I believe on Friday, Schefter spoke to Watson's personal quarterback coach, not the Texans employee, but Watson's, I guess, personal coach. And he said that a trade would happen by Sunday. That meant that a trade was going to happen within the next 48 hours. So Watson's personal quarterback coach, Watson's camp, wants to put out into the national narrative that a trade is imminent. So I tweeted this. You're an NFL GM. Why trade now with criminal charges looming and 20 civil cases waiting? Hold out until the price drops. So I don't know what GM in their right mind would say, hey, this is the perfect time to get him. We could potentially be placed on paid leave. We don't get him for the entire year, and we'll have to pay the salary. What a win for us. What a coup. I don't understand why you just don't wait there.
Because there's a discount off his face value here. At this point, at this juncture in time, the Houston Texans are not going to get the kind of value for Deshaun Watson that they might have been able to get 6 months ago. So if you're a general manager looking ahead, I think however this shakes out, whether he's placed on administrative leave or suspended for a period of time, this isn't going to carry over into 2022. So to have the opportunity to get one of the best quarterbacks in the National Football League with pretty much a 90% likelihood of playing football in 2022 at a discounted price without having to yield, you know, three or four number one draft choices, I think that might be worth exploring. However, you're basically sabotaging your 2021 regular season because it sends a message to the team that you're playing for next year, not this year. So that's why, as long as this is going on, it's hard to see a pathway to a successful trade for Deshaun Watson. I also want to shed light on some of my feelings about why the NFL may not place him on the administrative leave exempt list. And I think at this point in time, the NFL has interviewed at least 8 of the complainants. So they do have an ongoing investigation, but who they haven't heard from is Deshaun Watson. So I think at this point, hearing only one side of the events or one version of the events, it's difficult for the NFL to weigh in and render judgment with a form of discipline because they haven't heard both sides of the story. And for that reason, they may have no choice but to place Deshaun Watson on the paid leave list pending the completion of the investigation, which could take a long time if Watson is recalcitrant and is non-cooperative with the NFL investigation. But on the other hand, the league may not think very much of the, you know, they've conducted interviews with eight witnesses and may not necessarily place credence in sort of the veracity of these witness, you know, interviews and what these witnesses are accusing Watson of. I think if you had to put me to a choice one way or the other, he is going to end up on the commissioner's exempt list. Does that mean it's in perpetuity? No, I think he's looking at perhaps a suspension of, you know, anywhere from 6 games, maybe even a little longer. But this isn't going to go on forever. And a shrewd general manager might have the ultimate NFL futures trade at a steep discount off of the normal market value.
This is the ultimate farce. The Texans are saying, well, now we'll make him available. He's available to whoever wants him. I'm seeing that they're asking for 3 first-round picks, which seems to be the ask that it's always been. So I don't know. It doesn't really make sense to me. And I want to go back to what you said about the NFL's investigation. You raise an interesting point, and I touched on this on a different show, but we should hit it on ours. My understanding of the situation is the same as yours. The NFL has conducted investigations with some of the alleged victims, but has not yet spoken to Deshaun Watson. So, Dan, first of all, before I go into my soapbox, is that your understanding as well?
Yep, absolutely.
So let's say I am running the NFL's investigation. I'm just going to be honest. I would be doing it a little bit differently. Okay, here's what I would do. Same way like you catch someone in a lie on the stand. What I would do is I would probably bring Deshaun Watson in first. I'd want to get a statement from him as to what he thought happened. I'd go by all the girls one by one by one by one, you know, girls A through Z. I want to talk about all of them. Tell me everything you know about this one, that one. And I'd get him to, I'd write it down. And if I could get him to sign a statement, I'd have him sign a statement. But I'd want to lock in his version of events first, okay? And then what I would do, and mind you, the NFL has no subpoena power. Everyone's kind of voluntarily has to speak to the NFL. I would see which of the girls I could get. You know, I think the number is somewhere up to 20 plus at this point. And I don't think the NFL's spoken to all of them. I don't think everyone's cooperating, but I think they've spoken to a decent chunk. I would get those girls. I would ask to get their statements, okay? And I would get them to sign it if I could, a signed sworn statement. And then what I would do is I would bring Watson back in. And I would say, hey, you gave this signed sworn statement. They gave a signed sworn statement. They conflict in these particular ways. Let's get into it. Explain to me how they, and you try to essentially catch them in a lie. If you really want to conduct an investigation, that's how you do it. The way they've set it up is Watson has not dug his own grave because he's never really given a version of events. They're basically doing him a huge favor by not bringing him. But if they would have brought him in first, had the girls tell the story, and then Watson had to try to explain why he's changing his story now, it's a lot better way to do an investigation. I don't understand the logic of doing it backwards and letting Watson come in after to kind of clean up the mess. To me, it doesn't make sense.
He's under criminal jeopardy. He won't cooperate. He won't go in for an interview. The NFL probably would have welcomed him with open arms on day one, but his attorney, Rusty Hardin, understandably advised him not to cooperate with an NFL investigation while you face the prospect of possible criminal charges. That's just sort of textbook, you know, criminal defense lawyering. But what I'm really concerned about is the absence of any type of opportunity for cross-examination. You know, if you're going to suspend Deshaun Watson off of a civil allegation without any pending criminal charges, we've really lowered the bar on the NFL's disciplinary system. And we've really made the administrative leave exempt list the lowest possible barrier with basically no showing necessary except a possibility that somebody may be culpable for an offense like this.
But didn't Rob Manfred just do that? Didn't he just do the same exact thing?
It's a different sport. It's a different collective bargaining agreement. It's a different, you know, law of the shop. We can't mix and match sports. You know, what Gary Bettman may do in the National Hockey League doesn't create precedent for use by NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell. So I want to differentiate between the different employers and the different sports federations. It used to be not too long ago that players that were facing pending criminal charges not only didn't face any suspension, but those cases had to conclude before they were ever subjected to any kind of actual discipline or de facto discipline. Now, so much as a private, civil, unsworn complaint that is not advanced into any discovery can serve as the basis for shelving a player, albeit with paid leave for a significant chunk of that player's career. And you know, the average career expectancy of any NFL player is going to be a limited, finite period of time. If you sideline a player for any significant period, they may not come back as the same caliber of player. I think Adrian Peterson had some difficulties initially before he regained his stride. But, you know, just simply collecting your paycheck doesn't keep you as the same player while your peers are practicing and they're playing in real games. You're sitting on the couch. And I view the commissioner's exempt list as a form of discipline. And it's really a failing of the National Football League Players Association to have caved on this entire, you know, disciplinary system, which allows Commissioner Goodell pretty much free reign to sideline a player simply based upon a good faith belief and nothing more.
Yeah. So, I mean, I agree with you. If you want to be, if someone wants to be mad at someone, to be mad at the Players Association for allowing it. But I'm just telling you, Manfred, as much as it's not binding precedent, right, we'll call this persuasive precedent in the court of public perception. Manfred, just do it. There's going to be a lot of calling for Goodell to do the same thing. I mean, that's just the way I read it. But yeah, I mean, we could keep going, but let's move on. Okay, so Dan.
Hey, Dan, last week we spent a fair amount of our podcast episode talking about the prospective move of University of Texas and University of Oklahoma from the Big 12 to the SEC. There have been new developments seemingly on a daily basis. Can you bring us up to speed on the latest, Dan?
A couple things. And I don't want to spend too much time on this. I want to get to the vaccination issue. But here's what we have, right? We have a formal development. There's a lot of rumors, right, that Oklahoma and Texas are going to leave, but no one wanted to confirm it. So a joint statement from Texas and Oklahoma, which, number one, this occurred yesterday. This occurred on Monday. Joint statement from Texas and Oklahoma, before I get into the substance, very rare that two schools that are not connected, right, they would issue a joint statement together. So that tells you a little bit. These schools are moving in lockstep. They basically say that they have every intention of honoring their grant of rights agreement up until 2025. And then they're going to explore their options in a constantly shifting landscape of college football. So they're playing nice a little bit. They say, hey, by 2025, we're going to probably explore our options, but we're not going to breach our contract. We have no intention of doing that. We're going to let this thing run out. So obviously, it's still alarming to the Big 12 that these schools are leaving. Now, as this is happening simultaneously, we have an update today that the Big 12, right, that Texas and Oklahoma have formally told the SEC, we want to go. We want to go and to join your conference. So now this triggers the SEC bylaw that we talked about in the last podcast, the formal vote procedure. It requires 11 SEC schools to affirmatively accept Oklahoma and Texas. So here's where it gets kind of fun. I mean, let's see. I imagine they're going to get accepted. I don't think we'd be hearing all this Firestone. But Dan, you pointed out really very astutely on the last podcast. And if you haven't listened to it, I would implore you to check it out. You know, there was supposed to be this kind of gentleman's handshake by Texas A&M with the SEC schools that, hey, we're not going to allow Texas back in here, right? Because we want to be the only Texas school in the SEC. So Texas A&M, I'm just reading the reports like I'm sure everyone else is, but they were kept in the dark by these kind of like fly-by-night conversations between SEC Commissioner Greg Sankey and reportedly between these two schools. So we'll see if Texas A&M can sway the vote in their way and rule them out. But let's say, you know, let's have a fun academic exercise. If these two schools, Oklahoma and Texas, are adopted into the SEC and they become a super conference, right, the super league of college football, you know, I'm reading the reports, you know, in terms of income generated, they would be bringing in close to the same money that the NCAA as an entire unit brings in, right, just over $1 billion. So, you know, we've talked about, Dan, for years on this podcast, and you and I have gone back and forth on Twitter, whether the NCAA has too much power, right? If they're functioning almost akin to, you know, a monopoly, right? And there's antitrust concerns. But all of a sudden, if the SEC exists as this behemoth and they control and they have as much power and sway over college sports as any other entity, right? Maybe what's stopping at a certain point, what's stopping the SEC from defecting and creating a separate entity in and of itself to compete with the NCAA? Just issue spotting. I'm just talking about what the narrative is on college sports. We talk about college athletes maybe someday being employees and unionizing. We got to talk about what's on tap maybe for the conferences and potentially this huge power shift where the SEC collects all the top schools from the conferences and they say, you know what? We don't need these minority schools anymore. We don't need these smaller schools. We make all the money. We want to keep that bag to ourselves. So, Dan, I know it's a lot, but I don't know, Dan. I'm just so excited by all the different movements on the college sports landscape. I think it's exciting.
How would seceding and forming, you know, they're defecting from the NCAA, so to speak, how would that factor into the sort of the bowl championship series? Would they just exist in and to themselves and not participate in any of the bowl games? I think that would diminish the brand, and that would diminish the importance of any conference that would be a breakaway conference. You want to be part of this, you know, sort of this bowl series. Otherwise, you're just playing for SEC championships and nothing more.
I mean, Dan, would it? I mean, right now, the NCAA is not involved in college football. A couple of years ago, they separated. College football has nothing to do with the NCAA. And if you have the blue bloods of the schools, right, if you have Florida and LSU and Oklahoma and Texas and Ole Miss, I mean, that's your legacy. Texas and Oklahoma were the founding schools of the Big 12 Conference, at one point called the Big 8 Conference, right? And, you know, tradition, they don't really care. They left. You know, they want to leave. They want to go to the SEC. Nebraska went from the Big 12 and they went to the Big 10. So sometimes, Dan, it's all about the Benjamins. And I can tell you this, and we talked about in the last podcast, I don't know, it's not a small chunk of change. Last year, SEC schools, their dividend payout and revenue sharing paid out SEC schools about $45 million, okay? Over in Big 12 country, with Texas and Oklahoma, mind you, probably the top two schools just in terms of prestige in that conference, got paid out closer to $35 million. So $10 million gap. And that's with Texas and Oklahoma. So I don't know, maybe it's $15, $20 million a year. That's no small chunk of change for these schools. And maybe that's just in the NCAA structure. And if you take that, Dan, and you bring the SEC, quote unquote, the super conference, out of the NCAA structure and you let them exist on an island, you know, maybe Dan, it's infinitely more money. So I don't rule out these crazy scenarios. I mean, just that's where we're trending to at least.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's like kind of far ahead. What I'm looking at now is, you know, the Texas A&M, sort of, you know, idea that they moved to the SEC for the purpose of establishing their own identity and having Texas to themselves within the conference. As the junior member of the SEC, I think superficially, at least to me, they would seem powerless to stop the train or the momentum on this move from happening. You know, the fact that there've already been so many discussions and this dates back, you know, a period of time, I would think the writing is on the wall that this move is an inevitability. And the statements you hear coming out of the two schools, as well as the SEC, are designed to basically negotiate the price of defection to the lowest possible price. You have Texas and Oklahoma saying we're going to live up to our grant of rights agreement until 2025. And now on the other hand, you have the SEC saying, well, we didn't approach them. We didn't tortiously interfere with the contractual relationship between Texas, Oklahoma and the Big 12. So there's a lot of posturing going on, but ultimately, I think there will be a negotiated solution that will allow these two schools to move to the SEC without having to wait until 2025. And one thing to point out about Texas and Oklahoma, they are playing in states that either have or will soon have legalized sports betting, and the value of sponsorships around sports betting will be a lot easier to negotiate without the oversight of the NCAA. So I could think of millions of reasons why the SEC would want to break away from the NCAA and create its own policy around sports wagering and not have the NCAA vetoing or preventing their member institutions from accepting money from casinos and gambling companies. And with some of the schools playing in major markets and major college football states, the sports betting sponsorships alone that these schools can enjoy on an annual basis could approach, you know, eight figures annually.
Listen, I'm with you. I think it'd be a lot of fun. We had our talk 2 weeks back then on Barstool. I mean, I'm just pointing out what the rules. The NCAA has been very archaic on gambling and alcohol. You know, sometimes competition is good. Just ask the American Basketball Association, the NBA. It's always good to have a competitor, just like we talked about in the last podcast with AEW and WWE. Good to have a competitor in the mix. Just, again, issue spotting long-term. People looking for notes and articles to write or different topics to kind of see what's kind of buzzing on Twitter. If this move is completed, which, Dan, you and I both are in agreement, I do think it's going to happen. The SEC all of a sudden has 16 schools, okay? The Big 12 will be down to 8. You would be kidding yourself if you didn't think that other schools would be moving. The Big 12 is quote-unquote a Power 5 conference. They're going after other conferences, I would imagine, right? They're going after lesser conferences and maybe some other Power 5 conferences. Maybe they knock on the door of some of the Big 10 schools and they say, hey, we'll pay you more money. We'll give you a bigger share of the pie. Come help us save our conference. So, yeah, it's definitely an exciting time for college sports. But, yeah, expect that musical chairs to continue to move. Wouldn't make sense to have an SEC with 16 schools and the Big 12 with 8. So, again, this happened about 9 years ago. History kind of repeating itself. Dan, anything else to add before we move over to our final topic?
No, I think that covers it. We could talk about it, the SEC, Oklahoma, Texas, every episode for weeks and weeks, months going into the time it actually happens. This is the biggest story in college football, but I think we've covered, I think, some of the more salient events of the recent couple of days. I'm sure we'll have more to talk about as these events unfold.
Okay, so Dan, that brings us to our final topic. This is, we'll say, the NFL's debate, debacle with COVID, however you want to call it. The NFL did something, we'll say, interesting that other leagues have not chosen to do. And the NFL, they sometimes tend to beat to their own drum. NFL has essentially, you know, in a direct or indirect way, has basically told players and coaches, you need to get vaccinated. And if you don't get vaccinated, great, you know, it's on you. If you don't want to, it's fine. But it's going to cost your team and your teammates. It's going to cost them financially. So players, high-profile players like DeAndre Hopkins, Cole Beasley, coaches like Rick Dennison, have spoken out against the virus and the NFL's decision to basically jam this down the throat, or jam this down their arm, so to speak. So, you know, it's interesting. I think it's I'm surprised that we're not hearing more from the heads of the NFLPA, if their members are really upset at this. But Dan, I don't know. I turn it to you. I find the topic fascinating. You know, it's a monkey see, monkey do league. Again, even though this is not binding precedent on the NBA and Major League Baseball, we know that each of the sports dealt with scheduling issues, and even to some extent, baseball is still dealing with it. So, you know, it's something that I'm sure the other leagues are watching closely to see if they're going to want to adapt. So, Dan, I turn it to you. Thoughts on the COVID debate going on at the NFL levels?
Yeah, sure. First, let's understand that there's a distinction between the coaches, front office executives, equipment managers, scouts. They're treated as tier one staff. And they have to get vaccinated. They're not subject to any kind of a collective bargaining agreement as the players are. So the NFL policy requires all these individuals, including the position coaches on the teams, to get vaccinated. And Rick Dennison refused the vaccine, doesn't want to do it, and doesn't want to take it. And for that reason, he's not going to be coaching with the Minnesota Vikings this year. Whether he has a viable legal claim or not against his employer remains to be seen. But certainly when you think about the logic here of having, you know, teams being cloistered together, 50 players, a dozen coaches, and all these, you know, individuals around the team on a daily basis, I think it's pretty sound policy to at least require, your employees and key people to get the vaccine. And this is not, shouldn't be a controversial subject, although of course it is around the country, but I think Tom Pelissero has pointed out that the numbers are actually much better than this controversy would seem to suggest. I mean, 83% of NFL players have received at least one shot of the vaccine. 10 clubs have exceeded the 90% threshold. So I think the problem isn't as widespread as some of the recent media reports would lead you to believe, but there are some very well-publicized holdouts. But if they don't want to get vaccinated, then they're going to be subjected to the kinds of, you know, social distancing requirements and, you know, use of masks and other types of impediments that may call into question whether there's going to be any indirect or informal action taken against these players. Because unless we're talking about a star player, if you're a borderline player, someone who might be on the bubble, and you're not vaccinated, I don't care how the coaching staff or the general manager positions it in terms of public statements. I would think that if you're not capable of being in the room during meetings, sitting next to your coaches, sitting next to your, you know, your teammates, your fellow offensive line members, that creates a real problem within, you know, as part of the off the field instructional part of running a team, coaching a team. And there are going to be some surprising cuts here. So I think it's in the player's best interest to try to get more and better education around vaccination. But I would imagine that there are going to be teams that make these difficult decisions, maybe not outwardly based upon the lack of vaccination, but they'll couch it as something else. But I can't imagine that this wouldn't end up having adverse impacts on a player's viability with the team unless he's a core established player.
You know, Dan, we'll see. I mean, you know, it's funny, you know, I sports and politics, as much as we'd like them, you know, I view sports as an escape. I'm not the most political person in the world. You know, sometimes politics blends into sports, but this conversation kind of almost unavoidably exposing people that want to have the virus and that don't want to have the virus. Everyone's entitled to their own opinion and views of different vaccinations and medications and whatnot. But you know, I just, you know, the NFL certainly forced the issue by doing this, and people, DeAndre Hopkins, you know, credit to him, well, you know, is stating his opinion. He's not seemingly afraid. He's almost threatening retirement if this rule goes into play. So
the league got through it last year without mandatory vaccinations, but the Delta variant and the recent spike in cases, I think, is a significant change from where things stood last September and October. And, you know, if I was on an NFL team, I would be hesitant about being in close contact with someone who hasn't been vaccinated. I mean, this is real life. And I think it could create fissures and divisions within a team. And we're already seeing that play out. So the teams that have the highest percentage threshold of players who are vaccinated, I think, may have a better chance of long-term success, because this could divide a locker room. I mean, if quarterback controversies could divide a locker room, life and death issues surrounding infections, surrounding a virus, could have a much greater impact on a team's, I guess, chemistry and just team harmony. This is a serious issue. So I think this is really the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, but talk about chemistry. Imagine if someone, you know, some an unvaccinated player, say DeAndre Hopkins, just an example, if they trace back the cancellation of a game to DeAndre Hopkins, and all of the players don't get paid for that game. I mean, talk about chemistry. I mean, everyone's entitled to their own views on the vaccination, but everyone's also entitled to get really angry at you if your views on the vaccination cause everyone to lose their paychecks for the game. So similar concept into what you and I spoke about on the Deshaun Watson level. It's like, hey, this is a rule. Okay, so this is the rule. So you could take it or leave it, but that's the rule at this point. So you got to understand the rules and understand the consequences for violating the rules.
I mean, the Utah Jazz went through that similar situation, you know, with the first case in professional sports of a player testing positive, for coronavirus. That ruptured that locker room. The two star players weren't talking to each other for a while. So maybe that was sort of in the early part of COVID-19 when there wasn't a lot of understanding. I think we've evolved and there's been a lot more education and treatment surrounding it. But this will definitely split locker rooms in ways that no other controversy, you know, playing time or who's the quarterback. This could be a serious deal for teams that don't have their players, you know, moving in the same direction. And unless you're talking about 90% or greater, this could be a serious, chemistry issue, no pun intended, but this could be harmful, not only to the players involved, but this will inevitably become a divisive issue and an issue that detracts from where the focus should be, which is on game planning for the following week's game and playing the game. Players need to be dialed in and focused on their jobs and on the task at hand. And this has the ability to create tension within the locker room.
Okay, so Dan, I think that puts a pin in it. We'll obviously keep a close eye on it. I'm sure we're going to hit this topic again at some point. So Dan, you know, we do this lovely segment called What to Watch For. I'll give you one. I'll give you some time. If you didn't think about one, I'll give you some time to think of one now. When people are listening to this, it will depend on what time it is, but we are within the 30-day window of my class starting up at New York Law School, my sports law class. So I have a syllabus and I keep, you know, adjusting it now with new news, with the college, you know, conference realignment, even the Guardian stuff. I'm thinking if I should put that in. So getting a little excited, getting a little nervous, but it's almost time for day one of classes. I thought I was done going to school, Dan, and now I'm back all of a sudden. So it's
I can tell you from personal experience, go in with a strong lesson plan and outline. Don't wing it. I've learned, you know, from trial and error that having a sort of a compass of where you want to go and what topics you want to cover and having a sequential outline will allow you to remain focused and also to deliver the material in a very cogent, organized way. It's difficult to wing, you know, a law course over the course of 1 hour, 2 hours. So you have the knowledge and it's just a matter of how you want to present the material. So I wish you good luck at New York Law School. Very lucky to have you and it should be a fun experience. So enjoy it. I mean, it's one of the coolest jobs and side gigs that, you know, you could have in sports law. And I view it as an opportunity and you're not shy and you're not bashful about talking. But it is, I would view it or approach it almost tantamount to how you would approach an oral argument. You know, just be prepared for every hour of class time. You have to do multiple hours of preparation to distill the material to a digestible form to be able to lecture on that topic for an hour. And if you're prepared, it will be so easy and fun.
Agreed. I'm excited about it. Dan, anything on your what to watch for?
Jeez, I think we covered quite a bit. We'll let the events come to us as they may. You know, some of these things you can never predict and they just end up on our radar. And that's the really exciting thing about sports law, that there's no shortage of material. We're never going to run out of topics. So I'll just wait and see what the week approaches brings us. And I'm sure we'll be talking about vaccinations, Oklahoma, Texas, but hopefully some new litigation, which I'm always eager to follow.
Dan, you and I didn't clear this, but I figured it's worth a shot. I listened to a podcast, Ryan Russillo's show on the Ringer Network. He does this thing, Dan, it's really interesting. It's called Life Advice. And people ask him questions like, hey, I have a long distance relationship. Should I keep it? You know, and about tipping, you know, with another couple or dog sitting, how much? And he just goes over these interesting life advice issues. I'm sure I'm probably explaining too much for people that listen to Russillo's show. It's a very popular show. Dan, you and I get a lot of inquiries from law students, different advice about jobs, about classes, about, you know, how to work in sports law. I posted something on Instagram, you know, I just kind of tongue in cheek, you know, what's something that is like an Olympic sport, but it's not actually an Olympic sport. So I said, Dan, just joking, I said having two kids under two, because that's the world I live in now. Stephanie Weissenberger, who obviously is now studying for the bar, wrote Studying for the Bar, because that's a good one. And then I got an interesting one from, I can shout out her name because I use it on Instagram, Carolina Barrado. She's a, I think, a recent graduate of Miami Law. She said, very interesting.
Is she a reporter?
No, not that I'm aware of. But she, good reporter name if she did, but she basically said getting like a last minute assignment, having to argue a case at the last minute that you got from a partner, something like that. And I'm like, yeah, that's a terrible situation. Yeah, that is like the Olympics, but that's just being thrown into the fire. So then I thought of it and I'm like, you know what, Dan, you and I are pretty good. We've seen a couple things. I'm like a young lawyer, Dan, you're like a grizzled vet. Why don't people give us issues? Why don't people like Caroline? She kind of threw me that issue. She said I could post on Instagram. So how about this, Dan? If people have an issue, we'll keep it confidential. We won't use your name or anything. If you have a question about a class, you have an issue with a teacher, your study group's having a problem, maybe, Dan, maybe we'll open up the wormhole here, but I'm happy to give some advice. If you want to send us an email at condetrimental, condetrimental at gmail.com. Let's see how many we get, Dan. If we get some good ones, maybe we share it here. What to watch for, and then we'll do some life advice. What do you think about that?
I don't know if I'm anyone to be giving advice. So
you turned yourself into a sports gambling guru and you're out of an appellate lawyer. So you have some pretty good advice. I'm sure of it.
Yeah. You know, I'm not going to turn anybody away, but.
And former big law. You worked at Weil Gotchel at once upon a time.
That's right. I worked at the same law firm at the same time with Jeffrey Kessler, who went on to do a few big things in the legal profession. And I also worked alongside, not in the same practice, but alongside Jeffrey Klein, who ended up as the counsel of record for Zion Williamson in last year's famous case brought by Gina Ford, which, by the way, is still ongoing in the Miami-Dade County Circuit Court and in the North Carolina Federal District Court. So I'm going to have to revisit that at some point, but it's hanging on by a thread. It hasn't been fully resolved yet. They're still plugging away, trying to get Zion to pay money.
Again, new listeners of the show, Dan and I spent a couple of weeks going over the Zion Williamson case. So that's what brought Dan and I together once upon a time. Okay, so I think that'll put this episode in the books. As always, we are open to any and all contributors to conductdetrimental.com. We had some great articles this week. I'm going to shout out one, Danny Bland, the 3L editor-in-chief at Villanova, who told me in her byline, which I was so impressed by, Dan, a 12-time All-American at the NCAA level. We have writing for our site. You know, so, Dan, we've got some, diamonds here that just decided to write for us. So I'm happy to, if you have a background like that, you know, it's not by no means required, but if you have one, I am going to shout that out across all forms of social media.
I'm also excited about the possibility of deploying all these various individuals who could become, you know, sort of live correspondents covering court hearings and basically weighing in, covering different, you know, cases and controversies within the legal world surrounding sports. So one of the great things about having Conduct Detrimental and being able to bring aboard so many talented law students and young lawyers is it creates unlimited potential for what we could do on this, not only this podcast, but what we could do with the website going forward. And, you know, a year ago, we were basically just starting, you and I, to do our own episodes together, where it was hanging by a thread before. I was doing them sporadically. And now what we've been able to accomplish in just one short year and having all these, you know, new people contributing such valuable and insightful work product, it energizes me about the future of Conduct Detrimental. So as you could see from our off-camera discussions, it sparked a lot of ideas for how I want to view our website and our podcast going forward. Really, there's unlimited potential.
Dan, you know, very exciting times. And you on the last podcast said that Clay Travis replied to you. I got a quote retweet from the one and only Patricia Heaton, the Deborah Romano from Everybody Loves Raymond, gave me a shout out for that Cleveland Guardians tweet. So, Dan, you know what?
She loves sports writers. What can you say?
She loves sports writers. And guess what? Everybody loves Raymond. Everybody loves sports law. With that said, Dan Wallach, as always, is at Wallach Legal. Myself, at Sports Law Lust, the show, at ConDetrimental, and at ConductDetrimental.com. For Dan and myself and the rest of the Conduct Detrimental gang, we will see you next week on another episode of Conduct Detrimental.